Welcome back, Catholic Caption. Always great to catch up with my dear friend Steve Ray, and I had the chance to chat with him briefly and his beautiful wife Janet last night. It was great to see them in person and give them a big Christmas hug in southeastern Michigan. Okay, I'm really looking forward to this conversation because it's so important to get rid of some of those myths that are out there. People like to tell these stories and think they know so much about Jesus and his birth in Bethlehem. Steve Ray, of course, really needs no introduction. You know his great work from EWTN and Ave Maria Radio, EWTN Television, Ignatius Press, his brand new book on Genesis, which came out recently. Oh, my goodness, his pilgrimages to the Holy Land and all over the world, and his many talks, his website, CatholicConvert.com, and also Footprints of God. Steve has been to the Holy Land, what I'm thinking, over 200 times now, right, Steve?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. And so you know Bethlehem.
We've led 100 pilgrimages, but we've been there, Janet and I, together over 200
times. Over 200 times, yeah. Amazing. Yeah. All right, so take us back to Bethlehem, first of all, because there are so many myths out there. I think a big myth was that people talk about him being born in a stable or a barn.
It's because, you know, Americans, we read the Bible with American eyes, and unfortunately that's a disadvantage. It's called anachronism, where we look at what the way we live and then we read it back into the story of the Bible. But the reality is it wasn't a barn with red, you know, wood on it and a silo, but it was a cave. They didn't have red barns back in the first century. They had caves, and I've been to Bethlehem many times, and when we filmed our movies, we went in the way out into the wilderness beyond Bethlehem, and there's still to this day caves all in the side of the hills, and in all of them, you find that it has a black roof because of the soot of fires that have been burned in those caves for hundreds and hundreds, even thousands of years, as shepherds and people lived in those caves and kept their sheep there at night. And they have on the ground of those caves things that look like raisins, but they're not, because this is where sheep lived, and they kind of very unsanitary, actually. But it's right from the very beginning it was understood that it was a cave that Jesus was born in, and then the church was built over that cave. And so it wasn't a barn, it was a cave.
It's interesting because, you know, if you look at it, and you know this from being to Italy many times, as we have, you see the different creche scenes from Italy, and all the very, they don't use actually any image of a barn. It's always a cave.
Yep. Yeah, it is, and I really like the ones that go out of their way to kind of create the atmosphere inside of a cave, you know, because that's really the way it was. You know, it's interesting that in the wilderness outside of Bethlehem, we found Bedouins that live in the caves with their sheep. They live right with the animals. In fact, the animals provide the warmth, the heat that comes off the animals, and it's... You know, we cannot comprehend living that way, but we found it many times out in the wilderness where the families lived with their sheep in the same cave, different section. But it's much more primitive than we realize, and we always read our American life and culture back into those times. But that's one of the beauties of going on a pilgrimage, is to go out and see the way it really was.
To get the reality
of it. First century.
Yeah, absolutely. Exactly. We're talking with Steve Ray about Bethlehem and Nativity myths this morning on Catholic Connection at EWTN. Okay, myth number two. We really have no idea where Jesus was born. Who came up with that one?
Well, a lot of people, there are skeptics all the time, as you know, Teresa, that try to debunk things and make a name for themselves. And around Easter and Christmas, all the time in magazines and articles and on TV, you've got these shows. But they're acting as though we've discovered something new. Jesus wasn't born there or something. There's these kind of things all the time. But first of all, where was he born? Bethlehem, and then in a cave. So let's deal with the Bethlehem issue first. Even from back to about 600 years before the time of Christ, the prophet Micah said, I'll sing the first line, O little town of Bethlehem. Mm-hmm. It's actually, Bethlehem, you are too little to be among the tribes of Judah, but from you shall come the great king. So even Herod and the Jewish leaders knew that the baby was going to be born, the king was going to come from Bethlehem. And so that we know that that's where it was, is Bethlehem. And also there's two Bethlehems. There's another one in the north. That's why it's called Bethlehem of Judea. So then born in a cave. This, we mentioned this already a little bit, but even from the very beginning, not only did they have sheep in caves, that's where sheep were, and manger, the word manger mean in French is mangiore, which means to eat. It's a place where sheep eat. So that is a big key to us because it's, you know, really unsanitary, you know, when sheep and animals chew their food, the saliva slops all over, and it's a big mess. I was raised on a farm, so I know these kind of things. But even in the early writers, there's a Justin Martyr talked about the cave. Origen, who lived in the Holy Land, who lived in that area, talks about the cave. And he said, in Bethlehem, if you go there, and this is in the very first centuries, I think he was in the 200s. In Bethlehem, you are shown the cave where he was born, and within the cave, the manger where he was wrapped in swaddling clothes. Jerome also, who in the 300s, he lived in those caves. That's where he translated the Hebrew and the Greek into the Latin Vulgate. And Jerome said that in the caves in Bethlehem, he describes the caves and where Emperor Constantine built a basilica over those caves. So we always knew where they were. But if you would have come there in the early first or second century, say, and you mm-hmm. You came to Bethlehem and said, I want to see the place where Jesus was born. And I read about it. Is it real? You find a little boy in the street and say, little boy, do you know where Jesus was born? He said, come with me, mister. Come with me. And he'd take your hand and he'd lead you over to the cave because everybody knew where this happened. It was a huge deal. Mm-hmm. And even Dr. of the Church, John Chrysostom, about 389, wrote that people still at this late date come to see the place where he was born.
Let's talk about the basilica built on the site.
Yeah, it was built there, I think, 324. You couldn't build churches before 313 because Christianity was an illegal mm-hmm. religion, and you couldn't. But after 313, when Constantine legalized Christianity, and then shortly after it became the religion of the empire, actually, after that they started building churches, and the first ones built there, some in Rome, St. John Lateran was one of the first, but Queen Helen came to Israel, to the land of Judea, called Palestine at the time, in those centuries, and she discovered those places. Emperor Hadrian, who was reigning in 135 AD, he built pagan shrines over the Christian sites to obliterate Christianity, but all he did was mark them. So when she came, they said Jesus was crucified and buried and rose again under that pagan shrine. He was born under that pagan shrine. She knocked them down, found the caves and all the historical evidence underneath those pagan shrines. Emperor Hadrian had only marked them for us, kind of like put them on the map.
Yeah.
And so then she built these four beautiful churches. One was over the crucifixion and tomb. Another one was Bethlehem. Another one was on the top of the Mount of Olives, where Jesus ascended into heaven and Pater Noster. And then another one that people don't realize that they built was in Hebron, over the place where the angel, three messengers came to Abraham when he was in mm-hmm. his tent in Genesis mm-hmm. 18. They built a church there too. So we knew, because even after she came and discovered the places and built churches, and nobody ever denied it after that, because those churches were built there, and we've been going to the same ones ever since.
Ever since, yeah. And we have about a minute and a half left before our break. Any news yet in terms of things are pretty quiet right now? They're not having any celebrations, unfortunately, in Bethlehem because of the war. Any idea, any sense, Steve, because you're so connected, as to when pilgrimages might resume? Any ideas?
Well, we lost November, December, January, and Delta canceled their flights through February 4th. I have a group going to Jordan and Israel at the end of February. So I'm still hoping that one flies, but it's iffy. We're waiting to see. It is getting quieter there now. And what people don't realize, Teresa, is that the fighting in Gaza is down in the south. It's not around Jerusalem and Bethlehem.
Right.
It's in the south, down by the Egyptian border. That's where all the fighting is going on. There is some in the north too, because Hezbollah is making trouble up in the north on the northern border. But if you and I were in Jerusalem today or at the Sea of Galilee, we wouldn't even know anything was going on. It would be pretty much life as normal. And so they're winning that war against Hamas. And you don't see, I'm locked into Jerusalem news sources. And every day I was getting 50 things, missiles coming in here and here. Those have stopped. That's almost non-existent anymore, because Israel is putting that all out of commission. So they're winning the war. It's going to slow down, and I'm hoping that we'll be back on pilgrimages soon.
I hope so, too, because there's nothing like being there. And, you know, we're describing it, and it's giving me the chills, and I'm just grateful that I've been able to be there so many times with you and Janet and Deacon Don walking groups through Bethlehem and Galilee and Jerusalem. And, oh, my gosh, it's just incredible. More on Bethlehem and some of the myths out there. And Steve Ray is with us. We'll talk more about the birthplace of our Lord when we come back on a Wednesday. Stay tuned. It's past the hour. It's a Wednesday morning. Always great to catch up with my friend Steve Ray, author, speaker, and fearless pilgrimage leader, CatholicConvert.com. Many books, his recent one by Ignatius Press on Genesis. It's a Bible study. It's awesome. He was on, I think, two segments on that wonderful book. You can find that at Ignatius, at the EWTN catalog, and also at Ave Maria's bookstore. Everywhere it's there. Okay, so we're talking about the myths around the birth of Jesus. Another one is that we think there were just three wise men. Uno, dos, tres. Where did we get that from?
Yeah. Well, because there's three gifts. And so you have the gold, frankincense, and myrrh. So
and about only three wise men could fit in a manger. So I guess they were trying to make it work.
And each one, you see three camels arriving with them, each carrying these Christmas packages in their lap. But there has been through history as few as two or as many as ten. So we don't know. It doesn't say how many magi or wise men there were. But I like the number three because of the gifts, and it's very practical.
Very Trinitarian,
But we don't know how many there were. And their names were Melchior. It's hard to say that one. It's M-E-L-C-H-I-O-R. Melchior, Caspar, and Balthazar. Those are their traditional names, but those names didn't come until later.
Right. I love those names, though. I love that.
It's still,
it evokes a very warm feeling that you kind of know something about the Magi that visited Christ. Okay, so this one is... I'm sorry. No, go ahead.
I was just going to joke and say I love the name Balthazar, but I don't think my son would have liked me naming him that.
All right, this one is kind of, I think, funny. The comments you make here. Can't be December 25th, one of the other myths, because it's winter and no sheep are in the fields. I love what you said. Whoever decided this must live in Minnesota. That's funny.
it's a funny thing because I've been to this in December, and there are sheep, but they have to eat. And I know that you could give them hay. And like when I was on a little farm, we had bales of hay, and we fed our animals. But they were still out in the winter. And I live in Michigan like you do, and it's very cold. There's snow on the ground today for those who aren't in Michigan. And we had animals. And they were always outside. We would throw the hay out into the fields and the horses, and we had a cow, and we had all the goats and all these things. And they ate outside, and the weather didn't bother them. So to say that they can't be December 22nd because it's too cold for sheep to be out. Remember, God gives them these really woolly coats. And when we want to wear warm coats, what do? We make them out of wool. So these animals, they did live in the fields year round. I've been out there. I can have my friends send pictures if anybody wants to know. My friends in Bethlehem will send your pictures. But even there's a passage in the Mishnah, which is the tradition of the Jews from the early, I think this first, second century, and it talks about the sheep being out in the fields during this period of time is Passover, which is a lot of times very cold too in February. Remember when you and I were there in March and we were walking the Via Della Rosa? What were we wading through, Teresa?
Snow.
Snow.
And
we
ice.
Never thought that maybe Jesus could have been crucified in a snowstorm, because that year when we were there, our feet were soaking wet and cold, but it was right near Passover time, and where Jesus was crucified, and we're in March wading through the snow through Jerusalem.
I remember that. And that sounds like another application from an American point of view, everybody thinking that everything has to be as it is here in the United States.
Yeah. That's we Americans sometimes think that way. Then everything has to be, or we're the center of the world and everything revolves around us. The world is like, really, we're a bubble. The rest of the world is not like America. America is very unusual in many ways.
Myth number five, we shouldn't celebrate. This is a big one. I've heard this quite a bit. We shouldn't celebrate Christmas because it's based on a pagan festival.
Yeah, and there's, I don't want to waste a lot of time getting buried in the weeds of all the, Saturnarius was a winter solstice, festival, and there was a lot of others. And we also say that Easter was a pagan festival and Christianity fell for it or took, you know, kind of got, take over these. But the reality is that Christianity doesn't become pagan because it celebrates something on that day. Rather, it redeems paganism. And even if it is on a pagan holiday, Christianity redeems it and gives those pagans, say, who were celebrating maybe Saturnarius, now they can say, well, you know what, we can celebrate and still celebrate, but now we're celebrating the real thing, which is Christmas and the birth of Christ. For example, Jesus, yeah, in those days, you stayed away from lepers. They had to go through the streets saying, unclean, unclean. But Jesus went and embraced the lepers. He touched them. He healed them. He didn't become a leper because he embraced them. Rather, they became holy. They became pure and healed. Christianity paganizes. Christianity redeems paganism. I like the passage where Paul is going through Athens and he sees all the altars to the gods, right, and there's one to an unknown god. And instead of criticizing them, he praises them for their religiosity, for their desire to know God, and he says, you know what, I'm going to tell you the name of that god. So this is, in a way, Paul redeemed that statue in a way. So Christianity does not become pagan because we, even if we do celebrate on what was formerly a pagan holiday, we redeem that pagan holiday. Right. We make it Christian, exactly.
All right, since we only have about 2 minutes left, I can't believe it's gone by so quickly.
Oh,
let's do the last one, number seven. And this one is relatively new, or even some Catholic commentators are trying to say this is true. Where the heck they got this idea, I have no idea. But lambs were wrapped in swaddling bands, thus pointing to Jesus as a Lamb of God.
Right. It's only recent, and it's not true either, that lambs, first of all, the Passover lamb had to be perfect and unblemished. So this is a great story, you know, and sometimes things, when they're too good to be true, they are. And that, here's the way it goes, is that in order to make a lamb perfect and without spot or blemish, you'd wrap him to protect him. And therefore, when you sold him to be a Passover lamb, he was perfect. But if you are if you're a lamb and you're wrapped up in swaddling clothes, how do you nurse from your mother? When we had animals, they went under their mother and they pushed up at the teats there and the udder, and they followed their mother around. If they're wrapped up in swaddling clothes, how in the world is a lamb going to eat when it's a baby? I would also recommend people look at Father Longenecker, Dwight Longenecker's book. He's got
book,
a new one out, The Secret of the Bethlehem Shepherds, and he deals with this. He went out and even asked the shepherds, do you do this? And they laughed. They said, no, we do it with our babies. We don't do it with our lambs. So the idea is that this is the story, is that that's what the shepherds were told, to go find the baby wrapped in swaddling clothes. And that's, they knew what that meant. They knew, because they wrapped their sheep in swaddling clothes. Then we see Jesus. Oh, he must be the Lamb of God. It's a great little story, but like so many other things, it's not true.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Steve, you always are so great in providing this information. Is there a blog or a link on your website that we can take a look at if folks want to go back over these myths, facts, and fiction?
Well, I didn't put these up. I'm still kind of developing them. I'm going to work on them. So, but I do have on my blog, you just do a search, go to CatholicConvert.com. There's a search bar. Type in myths. And I have seven myths, general myths, that, and a couple of these are in there, but I have the myths that there was a gate called the Eye of the Needle at there's another one, that's the shepherds break the legs of a wandering lamb to keep it close to them, and so it's called Six Biblical Myths Debunked. Sophie.
Okay.
But this new one, this one I did, Teresa, you're the first one I've ever done this with, and I'm still developing it.
Exclusive, heard first right here on Catholic Connection, as we used to say in the news business. All right, we're hoping to catch up with you to do another special for Epiphany, which I think is awesome. Steve, Merry Christmas to you and Janet and your beautiful family, and God willing, talk to you in the new year. More information on Steve, for him to speak or to lead a pilgrimage, CatholicConvert.com. We'll be right back.